He struggled to maintain focus, but lost himself. When he eventually returned to consciousness, his clothes clean and his hair and skin freshly washed, perhaps so the guild could reclaim every particle of melange, the shapely, red-haired proctor looked down at him. She gave Kater a winsome, sad smile and shook her head. "You blocked your mind to the spice gas, thereby shackling yourself to the normal world." Her next words came like a death sentence. "The guild cannot use you." Kater sat up, coughing. He sniffed, and his nostrils still tingled from the potent cinnamon stench. "I'm sorry nobody explained what I was supposed to..." She helped him to his feet, anxious to usher him out of the embassy building. His heart felt like molten lead. The proctor didn't need to answer him as she led him out to the reception area. Kater looked around, searching for his brother, but the waiting room was empty. Then he learned that his own failure wasn't the worst thing he had to face. "Where's Demur? Did he succeed?" Kater's voice filled with hope. The proctor nodded. "Admirably." She extended her hand toward the exit, but he sidestepped her. Kater looked back toward the inner corridor and the sealed testing chamber where his brother had gone. He needed to congratulate Demur, even though the victory was now bittersweet. At least one of them would become a navigator. "You will never see your brother again," the proctor said coldly. She moved to block the way back in. "Demur Pilru is ours now." Recovering after an instant of shock, Kater broke past the proctor and ran to the sealed chamber door. He pounded against it and shouted, but received no answer. Within minutes, guild guards surrounded him, more businesslike than gentle, and peeled him away. Still dizzy from the unaccustomed after-effects of melange exposure, Kater didn't realize where they were taking him. Blinking and disoriented, he found himself standing on the crystal walkway outside the blocky gray embassy. Below him, other walkways and streets bustled with traffic and pedestrians traveling from one tower building to another. Now he was more alone than ever. The testing proctor stood on the embassy steps, barring Kater from re-entering. Even though his mother worked somewhere inside, deep in the banking section, Kater knew that the doors of this facility, as well as the doors to the future he had counted on, were now locked to him. "Rejoice for your brother," the proctor called from the steps, her voice finally showing some life. "He has entered another world. He can travel to places you'll never imagine." "I can never see him or talk to him again," Kater said, as if part of him had been ripped away. "Doubtful," the proctor said, crossing her arms over her chest. She gave him an apologetic frown. "Unless he suffers a reversal. His first time your brother immersed himself so completely in the spice gas that he started the conversion process right there and then. The guild cannot deny such talent. He has already started to change." "Bring him back," Kater said, his eyes tear-filled now. He prayed for his brother. "Just for a little while." He wanted to be happy for his twin, and proud. Demur had passed the test that meant so much to both of them. The twins had always been so close. How could they possibly go on without one another? Perhaps his mother could use her guild banking connections so that they would at least be able to have their farewells. Or maybe his father would use ambassadorial privilege to get Demur back. But Kater knew that would never happen. He could see that now. His mother had already known it, had been afraid of losing both sons. "The process is, in the majority of cases, irreversible," the proctor said with finality. Guild security guards marched out to stand beside her. ensuring that Kater did not become irrational and try to force his way inside. "Trust me," said the proctor. "You don't want your brother back." The human body is a machine, a system of organic chemicals, fluid conduits, electrical impulses. A government is likewise a machine of interacting societies, laws, cultures, rewards and punishments, patterns of behavior. Ultimately, the universe itself is a machine. Planets around suns, stars gathered into clusters, clusters and other suns forming entire galaxies. Our job is to keep the machinery functioning. Suk Inner School, Primary Doctrine. Both frowning, Crown Prince Shaddam and Chamberlain Aiken Hezban watched the approach of a diminutive, scrawny man who nonetheless walked as tall as a Mutellian giant. After years of training and conditioning, all Suk doctors seemed compelled to take themselves far too seriously. That Elis Younger looks more like a circus performer than a respected medical professional, Shaddam said, looking at the arched eyebrows, black eyes, and the steel-gray ponytail. I hope he knows what he's doing. I want only the best care for my poor ailing father. Beside him, Hezban tugged on one of his long mustaches, but made no response. He wore a floor-length blue robe with golden piping. For years, Shaddam had disliked this pompous man who hovered too close to his father's presence, and he vowed to choose a new chamberlain after assuming the throne. And so long as this Suk doctor could find no explanation for Elrud's gradually worsening illness, Shaddam's ascendancy would be assured. Hasimir Fenring had emphasized that even all the resources of the exalted Suk inner school could not stop what had been set in motion. The catalyst chemical implanted in the old man's brain would register on no poison snooper, since it was not itself poison, but would only convert to a dangerous substance in the presence of spice beer. And as he felt worse and worse, old Elrud consumed ever-increasing quantities of the beer. No more than a meter in height, the shrunken doctor had smooth skin, but ancient eyes from the vast medical knowledge hammered into his mind. A black diamond tattoo marked the center of Youngar's creased forehead. His ponytail of steel-gray hair, secured in the back by a silver Suk ring, was longer than a woman's, reaching nearly to the floor. Wasting no time on further pleasantries, Elis Younger broached a familiar subject. "You have our payment?" He looked first at the chamberlain, then at the crown prince, where his gaze settled. "Fresh accounts must be established before we can begin treatment. Given the emperor's age, our care could be quite prolonged, and ultimately fruitless. He must pay his bills like every other citizen. King, miner, basket weaver, it makes no difference to us. Every human wants to be healthy, and we cannot treat everyone. Our care is available only to those willing and able to pay for it." Shaddam rested a hand on the chamberlain's sleeve. "Ah, yes, we will spare no expense for my father's health, Aiken. It is already arranged." They stood just inside the high-arched doorway of the Imperial Audience Chamber, beneath glorious ceiling frescoes of epic events from the history of the Carino family. The blood of the Jihad, the desperate last stand on the bridge of Hrethgir, the destruction of thinking machines. Shaddam had always found ancient imperial history ponderous and boring, with little relevance to his current goals. Centuries and centuries ago didn't matter. He just hoped it wouldn't take that long for a change in the palace. In the echoing hall, the Padishah Emperor's magnificent jeweled throne sat invitingly empty. Court functionaries and a few dark-robed Bene Gesserit scuttled about inside passages and alcoves, trying to remain unseen. A pair of heavily armed Sardaukar guards stood at the dais steps, attentive. Shaddam wondered whether they would obey him right now, knowing his father lay sick in his chambers. He decided not to test the idea. Too soon. "We are all familiar with promises," the doctor said. "Still, I wish to see the payment first." Stubborn tone, an impertinent upward gaze that didn't move from Shaddam, even though the Crown Prince hadn't done much talking. Youngar chose to play strange power games, but soon he would be out of his league. "Payment before even looking at the patient?" the Chamberlain gasped. "Where are your priorities, man?" Finally, Dr. Youngar deigned to look over at Hezban. "You have dealt with us before, Chamberlain, and you know the costs of producing a Sook doctor, fully conditioned, fully trained." As heir to the Golden Lion throne, Shaddam was familiar with Sook imperial conditioning, which guaranteed absolute loyalty to a patient. In centuries of medical history, no one had ever managed to subvert a graduate of the inner school. Some members of the royal court had a hard time reconciling the legendary Sook loyalty with their incessant greed. The doctors never wavered from the clear but unstated position that they would not minister to anyone, not even to an emperor, on a mere promise of remuneration. Sook doctors extended no credit. Payment had to be tangible and immediate. Youngar spoke in an irritating whine. "Though we are perhaps not as prominent as the Mentats or the Bene Gesserit, the Sook school is still one of the greatest in the Imperium. My equipment alone costs more than most planets." Youngar pointed to a suspensor pod at his side. "I do not receive your payment on my own behalf, of course. I am only a custodian, holding it in a fiduciary capacity. When I return, your credits go with me to the Sook school for the benefit of mankind." Hezban glared at him with unconcealed loathing, his face turning ruddy, his mustaches twitching. "Or at least to benefit that portion of mankind that can afford your services." "Correct, Chamberlain." Seeing the doctor's staunch and misplaced self-importance, Shaddam shuddered. When he sat on the throne himself, he wondered if he could initiate any changes to put these Sooks in their place. He caught his rambling thoughts and quelled them. All in due time. He sighed. His father Elrood had let too many threads of control slip right through his fingers. Fenring was right. As much as Shaddam despised dirtying his fingers with blood, removing the ancient emperor was a necessary action. "If cost of treatment is your paramount concern," the Sook doctor said, quietly goading the Chamberlain, "you are welcome to hire a less expensive physician for the Emperor of the Known Universe." "Enough bickering. Come with me, doctor," Shaddam said, taking charge. Dr. Youngar nodded, then turned his back on the Chamberlain, as if he was of no consequence whatsoever. "Now I know why you people have the shape of a diamond tattooed on your foreheads," Hezban growled as he followed behind them. "You always have treasure on your minds." The Crown Prince led the way to a security-shielded antechamber and passed through a shimmering electrical curtain to the inner vault. On a golden table at the center of the room lay opifier pendants, Danikins of Melange, and fold pouches partially open to reveal glittering Sue stones. "This will be sufficient," the Sook said, "unless the treatment proves to be more involved than we expect." With his floating equipment pod at his side like a dutiful pet dog, the doctor shuffled back the way they had come. "I already know the way to the Emperor's chamber." Without explanation, Youngar hurried through a doorway and up the grand staircase that led to the guarded bedroom suites where the Emperor rested. Sardaukar guards remained behind at the force field that protected the treasure vault, while Shaddam and Hezban marched after the doctor. Fenring would already be waiting at the dying old man's side, making his annoying humming noises and making sure none of the treatment could potentially be successful. The withered emperor lay on an enormous four-poster bed beneath a canopy of the finest myrrh silks embroidered in the ancient Terran method. The bedposts were carved ukka, a fast-growing hardwood native to Alaka. Soothing fountains, set into alcoves in the walls, trickled fresh water, bubbling and whispering. Scented glow globes, tuned to the low range, floated in the corners of the room. As Shaddam and Fenring stood together and watched, the Sook doctor waved a liveried attendant away and mounted the two shallow steps to the bedside. Three lovely imperial concubines hovered behind the ailing man, as if their mere presence could revitalize him. The old man's stink clung to the air, despite the ventilation and the incense. Emperor Elrood wore slick royal satins and an old-fashioned sleeping cap that covered his liver-spotted scalp. He lay atop the covers, since he had complained about being too warm. The man looked haggard, could barely keep his eyes open. Shaddam was pleased to see how markedly his father's health had declined since the Tleilaxu ambassador's visit. Still, Elrood had good days and bad days, and he had the annoying habit of recovering his vitality after a significant downslide like this one. A tall mug of cool spice beer rested on a tray beside his clawed and ring-bedecked hand, next to a second empty mug. And, mounted on the bed canopy, Shaddam noted the waving insect arms of a poison snooper. "You must be thirsty, father," Shaddam thought. "Drink more of the beer." The doctor opened his suspensor pod to reveal shiny instruments, clicking scanners, and colored vials of testing liquids. Reaching inside the kit, Youngar brought out a small white device, which he passed over Elrood. After tugging off the satin sleeping cap to reveal the sweaty scalp, Dr. Youngar scanned Elrood's skull, lifting the old man's head to check all around. Looking small and weak and old, the emperor grumbled at the discomfort. Shaddam wondered what he himself would look like after 150 years, preferably at the end of a long and glorious reign. He fought back a smile and held his breath during the examination. Beside him, Fenring remained calm and aloof. Only the chamberlain scowled. The doctor withdrew his scanner, then studied the imperial patient's case history cube. Presently, he announced to the groggy old man, "Even Melange can't keep you young forever, sire. At your age, health naturally begins to decline, sometimes rapidly." Inaudibly, Shaddam released a sigh of relief. With great difficulty, Elrood sat up, and his concubines propped tasseled pillows behind him. His cadaverous parchment face creased in a deep frown. "But only a few months ago I felt so much better." "Aging is not a perfect downhill graph. There are peaks and valleys, recoveries and slowdowns." The doctor had the audacity to use a know-it-all tone that implied the emperor could not understand such complex concepts. "The human body is a chemical and bioelectric soup, and changes are often triggered by seemingly inconsequential events. You have been under stress lately." "I'm the emperor," Elrood snapped, this time responding as if the Sook were unbearably stupid. "I have many responsibilities. Of course this causes stress." "Then start to delegate more to the Crown Prince and to your trusted aides, such as Fenring over there. You're not going to live forever, you know. Not even an emperor can do that. Plan for the future." Smugly, the doctor snapped shut his case. Shaddam wanted to embrace him. "I will leave you with a prescription and devices to make you feel better." "The only prescription I want is more spice in my beer." Elrood took a deep drink from his mug, slurping loudly. "As you wish," the scrawny Sook doctor said. From the suspensor pod he removed a satchel, which he placed on a side table. These are muscle-soothing devices in case you need them. Instructions are contained with each unit. Have your concubines use them on your aches. All right, all right, Elrood said. Now leave me, I have work to do. Dr. Youngar backed down the steps from the bed platform with a bow. With your permission, sire? Impatiently, the Emperor waved a gnarled hand in dismissal. The concubines moved about, whispering to each other, watching with wide eyes. Two of them picked up muscle-soothing devices and toyed with the controls. Shaddam whispered to one of the attendants to have the doctor go with Chamberlain Hezban, who would arrange for the transfer of payment. Hezban obviously wanted to stay in the bedchamber and discuss certain documents, treaties, and other state matters with the sick old man. But Shaddam, feeling he could take care of such things himself, wanted the dour advisor out of the way. When the sook was gone, old Elrood said to his son, "Perhaps the doctor is right, Shaddam. There is a matter I wish to discuss with you and Hasimir, a policy and project I wish to continue, regardless of my personal health. Have I told you about our plans on Ix and the eventual Tlelaxu takeover?" Shaddam rolled his eyes. "Of course, you old fool. Fenring and I have already done most of the work. It was our idea to send Tlelaxu face dancers to Ix, because they could disguise themselves and infiltrate the working classes." "Yes, father. We know of the plans." Elrood waved a hand to beckon them closer, and the old man's features darkened. Out of the corner of his eye, Shaddam saw Fenring chase the hovering concubines away, then approach to hear the Emperor's words. "This morning I received a cipher from our operatives on Ix. You know about the enmity between myself and Earl Dominic Vernius?"
"Ah, yes, we do, father," Shaddam said. He cleared his throat.
"An old affront, a stolen woman." Elrood's roomy eyes brightened. "It seems that our brash Dominic has been playing with fire, training his men with mobile fighting mechs that scan opponents and process data, probably through a computer brain. He has also been selling these intelligent machines on the black market."
"Sacrilege, sire," Fenring murmured. "That clearly goes against the strictures of the Great Convention."
"Quite so," Elrood agreed. "And this isn't the only infraction. House Vernius has been developing sophisticated cyborg enhancements as well. Mechanical body replacements. We can use that to our advantage." Shaddam frowned, leaning closer and smelling the sour spice beer on the old man's breath.
"Cyborgs? But they are human minds attached to robot bodies, and therefore not in violation of the jihad."
Elrood smiled. "But we understand there have been certain compromises. True or not, it's exactly the sort of excuse our impostors need to finish the job. The time to act is now. House Vernius is poised on the brink of destruction, and a small nudge will topple them."
That is interesting," Fenring said. "Then the Tlelaxu can take over the sophisticated Ixian facilities for their research."
"This is very important, and you will watch how I handle this situation," Elrood said with a sniff. "Watch and learn. Already I have set my plan in motion. Ixian suboid workers are, shall we say, troubled by these developments. And we are..." The Emperor paused to finish his mug of spice beer with a smack of his lips. "Encouraging their discontent through our own representatives." Setting down the empty mug, Elrood grew suddenly lethargic. He adjusted his pillows, shifted onto his back, and fell into a fitful sleep. Exchanging a knowing glance with Fenring, Shaddam thought of the conspiracy within the conspiracy, their own secret participation in the events on Ix, and how he and Fenring had put the Tlelaxu master in contact with Elrood in the first place. Now the Beni Tleilaqs, employing their own genetically altered shapeshifters, were stirring up religious fervor and discontent among Ix's lower classes. To the fanatical Tleilaqsu, any hint of a thinking machine, and the Ixians who created them, was the work of Satan. As the two young men left the Emperor's chamber, Fenring smiled with similar thoughts. "Watch and learn," the old fool had said. "Elrud, you condescending bastard, you have much to learn yourself, and no time left in which to learn it." The leaders of the Butlerian Jihad did not adequately define artificial intelligence, failing to foresee all possibilities of an imaginative society. Therefore, we have substantial gray areas in which to maneuver. Confidential Ixian legal opinion. Though the explosion was distant, the concussion rocked the table where Leto and Romber sat studying sample resource ledgers. Small chunks of decorative plascrete trickled from the ceiling above them, where a long crack had just appeared. A jagged lightning bolt zigzagged across one of the broad plas observation windows, fracturing it. "Vermilion hells, what was that?" Romber said. Leto had already surged to his feet, knocking the ledgers aside and looking for the source of the explosion. He saw the far side of the underground grotto, where several badly damaged buildings crumbled into rubble. The two young men exchanged blank looks. "Get ready," Leto said, instantly on guard. "Ready for what?" Leto didn't know. They had gone together into one of the tutorial rooms of the Grand Palais, first studying calculus philosophy and the underpinnings of the Holtzmann effect, and then Ixian manufacturing and distribution systems. On the walls around them, ancient paintings hung in hermetically sealed frames, including works of the old Terran masters Claude Monet and Paul Gauguin, with interactive plates that allowed enhancements by Ixian depth artists. Since Leto had reported his adventure down in the Saboid tunnels, he had heard of no further discussions or investigations. Perhaps the Earl hoped the problem would just go away. Another concussion rocked the room, this one closer, stronger. The Prince of Ix gripped the table to keep it from toppling. Leto rushed over to the cracked window. "Romber, look out here!" From the crosswalk streets connecting the stalactite buildings, someone screamed. Off to the left, an out-of-control transport capsule plummeted to smash into the ground far below with a spray of crystal shards and mutilated passengers. The door to the tutorial room crashed open. Captain Jaz of the Palace Guard burst in, carrying one of the new pulsed assault laser guns. Four subordinates followed him, all armed in the same fashion, all wearing the silver and white uniforms of House Vernius. No one on Ix, especially not the Earl himself, had ever thought Leto or Romber would need the protection of personal bodyguards. "Come with us, young masters," Jaz said, breathing hard. The man's dark eyes, framed by his squarish brown beard, darted with excitement as he noted the stone fragments falling from the ceiling, then the cracked window plas. Though he was ready to fight to the death, Jaz clearly didn't understand what had taken place in the normally peaceful city of Verniae. "What's happening, Captain?" Romber asked, as the retinue of guards hustled them out of the room and into the corridor, where the lights flickered. His voice quavered for a moment, then sounded stronger, like an Earl's heir should. "Tell me, is my family safe?" Other guards and members of the Ixian court ran helter-skelter, with excited shouts ringing out, high-pitched and strident, in counterpoint to yet another explosion. From far below came the hubbub of an angry mob, so distant it sounded like a deep murmur. Then Leto made out the buzzing hum of lasergun fire. Even before the captain answered Romber, Leto guessed the source of the disturbance. "There's trouble with the Saboids, my lords," Jaz shouted. "Don't worry, though, we'll have it under control soon." He touched a button on his belt,
and a previously unseen door opened in the marble-mirrored wall. The captain and the household guard had drilled and prepared for so long against large-scale external attacks, they didn't seem to know how to deal with a revolt from within. This way to safety. I'm sure your family will be there waiting for you. When the two young men ducked under the low half-door behind the mirrors, the portal sealed shut behind them. In the yellow light of emergency glow-globes, Leto and Romber ran alongside an electromagnetic track, while the captain of the guard shouted frantically into a tiny handheld commceiver. Lavender light flashed from the face of the instrument, and Leto heard the metallic sound of a responding voice. "Help is on the way!" Seconds later, an armored personnel car roared along the sheltered track and screeched to a stop. Jaz boarded with the two young heirs and a pair of guards, leaving the rest of the security men behind to defend their exit. Leto tumbled into a bucket seat, while Jaz and Romber clambered into the front. The rail car began to move. "Suboids blew two of the diamond columns," Jaz said, breathlessly consulting the lavender screen of his commceiver. "Part of the overhead crust has collapsed." His face turned gray with disbelief, and he scratched his brown beard. "This is impossible." Leto, who had seen the signs of the gathering storm all along, knew that the situation was probably even worse than the guard captain imagined. Ix's troubles would not be solved within an hour. A metallic-voiced report clattered in, sounding desperate. "Suboids are boiling up from the lower levels. How could they become so organized?" Romber cursed, and Leto looked knowingly at his stocky friend. He had tried to warn the Ixians, but he did not point out the fact. House Vernius had not been willing to consider the seriousness of the situation. In the rail car, a safety harness snapped into place over Leto as soon as he situated himself, and the car continued to accelerate with a smooth hum, traveling at high speed upward into caverns hidden in the rock ceiling. Captain Jaws worked a comm board at the front of the compartment, his fingers dancing over the communication keys. A blue glow surrounded his hands. At his side, Romber watched the guard captain intently, as if knowing he might be expected to take charge. "We're in an escape pod," one of the secondary guards explained to Leto. "You two are safe for now. The suboids won't be able to penetrate our upper defenses once we have them activated." "But what about my parents?" Romber asked. "And Kylia?" "We've got a plan for this, an option. You and your family should all meet at a rendezvous point. By all the saints and sinners, I hope my people remember what to do. For the first time, it isn't a drill." The car made several track changes, clicking and humming along with increased speed, and then ascended steeply into darkness. Presently the track leveled off, and the vehicle was bathed in light as it sped past an immense window wall of one-way armor plaz. They caught just a glimpse of the riots down below, flares of spontaneous fires and swirling demonstrations going on beneath the city. Another explosion, and one of the transport upper walkway tubes shattered, tumbling in shards to the floor of the cavern far below. Tiny, puppet-like figures of pedestrians flailed and fell to their doom. "Stop here, Captain," Romber cried. "I need to see what's happening out there." "Please, sir, keep it to a few seconds," the captain said. "The rebels could breach that wall." Leto found it hard to comprehend what he was hearing. Rebels? Explosions? Emergency evacuations? Ix had seemed so sophisticated, so peaceful, so protected from discord. Even dissatisfied with their lot, how could the suboids have orchestrated such a massive and coordinated assault? Where could they have gotten the resources? Through the one-way panel, Leto saw uniformed Vernius soldiers fighting a losing battle against swarms of the pale, smooth-skinned opponents down on the grotto floor. The suboids hurled crudely made explosive or incendiary devices, while Ixians cut the mobs down with purple beams of laser gun fire. "Comm Command says the suboids are rebelling on all levels," Jaz said in a tone of disbelief. "They're screaming jihad as they attack." "Vermilion hells! Romber said. What does the jihad have to do with anything? What could it have to do with us?
We need to leave the window, sir, Jaws insisted, tugging at Romber's sleeve. We have to make it to the rendezvous point. Romber lurched back from the window as part of a tiled street collapsed behind it, and wave upon wave of the pale suboids scrambled out of the dark tunnels beneath. The railcar picked up speed along the track and curved left into darkness, then ascended again. Romber nodded to himself, his face pinched and distressed. We've got secret command centers on the upper levels. Precautions have been taken for this sort of thing, and by now our military units will have surrounded the most vital manufacturing facilities. It shouldn't take long to subdue this. The Earl's son sounded as if he were trying to convince himself. At the front of the car, Jaws leaned intently over the comm board, which cast his face in pale light. Look out! Trouble ahead, sir! He wrenched the controls. The rail car rocked, and Jaws took a sidetrack. The other two guards brought their weapons to bear, squinting into the rocky darkness all around them, ready to fire. Unit 4 has been overrun, Captain Jaws said. Suboids broke through the sidewalls. I'm trying for 3 instead.
Overrun? Romber said,
and his face flushed with either embarrassment or fear.
How in the hells could the suboids do that?
Comm Command says Tleilaxu are involved, and some of their face dancers. They're all heavily armed. He gasped as he stared at the reports flowing in. May God protect us. Questions fell in an avalanche around Leto.
Tleilaxu?
Why would they attack Ix?
Jihad?
This is a machine planet, and the Tleilaxu are religious fanatics. Do they fear Ixian machines enough to use their tank-grown shapeshifters to infiltrate the suboid workforce? That would explain the coordination. But why would they be so interested? Why here? As the railcar soared along, Jaws scrutinized the comm board, where he received battle reports.
By all the saints and sinners, Tleilaxu engineers have just blown the pipelines that feed heat from the molten core of the planet.
But we need that energy to run the factories, Romber cried, still hanging on to his seat.
They've also destroyed recycling lines where the industrial waste and exhaust chemicals are dumped into the mantle.
Now the captain's voice sounded more ragged.
They're hitting at the heart of Ix, paralyzing our manufacturing capacity.
As Leto thought back on what he had learned during his months on this planet, pieces of the puzzle began fitting together in his mind.
Think about it, he said. All of that can be fixed. They knew exactly where to hit in order to cripple Ix without causing permanent damage.
Leto gave a grim nod, the reason suddenly clear to him.
The Tleilaxu want this world and its facilities intact. They plan to take over here.
Don't be ridiculous, Leto. We'd never give Ix to the filthy Tleilaxu. Romber looked perplexed, more than miffed.
We may not have any choice in the matter, sir, Jaws said.
At Romber's barked command for weapons, one of the guards opened a cabinet beneath the rail car and brought out a pair of flechette pistols and shield belts, which he handed to both princes. Without questioning, Leto snapped on the belt, touched a test button to confirm that the unit was operational. The projectile weapon felt cold in his hand. He checked its clip of deadly darts, accepted 2 additional packs from the guard, and slid them into compartments on the shield belt. The escape pod thundered into a long, dark tunnel. Ahead, Leto saw light, which grew larger and brighter by the second. He remembered what his father had said to him about the Tleilaxu. They destroy anything that resembles a thinking machine. Ix would have been a natural target for them. The light ahead touched them now, dazzling his eyes, and they roared into it. Religion and law, among the masses, must be one and the same. An act of disobedience must be a sin and require religious penalties. This will have the dual benefit of bringing both greater obedience and greater bravery. We must depend not so much on the bravery of individuals, you see, as upon the bravery of a whole population.
Pardit Kynes, addressed to gathered representatives of the greater Sitches. Oblivious to the fate that had been decided for him, Pardit Kynes strolled through the tunnels, accompanied by his now faithful companions Amun and Turok. The three went to visit Stilgar, who rested and healed in his family chambers. At first sight of his visitor, Aleen Stilgar sat forward on his sickbed. Though his wound should have been fatal, the Freeman youth had almost entirely recovered in a short time. "I owe you the water of my life, planetologist," he said, and with great seriousness spat upon the floor of the cave. Kynes was startled for a moment, then thought he understood. He knew the importance of water to these people, especially the precious moisture contained within a person's body. For Stilgar to sacrifice even a droplet of saliva showed him a great honor. "I appreciate your water, Stilgar," Kynes said with a forced smile. "But you may keep the rest of it for now. I want you to be well." Freeth, Stilgar's quiet sister, stayed by the young man's bedside, always busy, her blue-in-blue eyes darting from side to side in search of something else to do. She looked long at Kynes, as if assessing him, but her expression was unreadable. Then she silently glided off to bring more unguents that would speed her brother's healing. Later, as Kynes walked along the Sitch passageways, curious people gathered to follow him and listen. In the midst of their daily routines, this tall, stubble-bearded planetologist continued to be something new and interesting. His crazy but visionary words might sound ridiculous, the most preposterous of fantasies, but even the Sitch's children tagged along after the stranger. The bemused and talkative crowd accompanied Kynes as he lectured, gesturing with his hands, gazing at the ceiling as if he could see the open sky there. Though they tried, these freemen could not imagine the sight of clouds gathering to pour rain upon the desert. Droplets of moisture falling from the empty sky? Absurd! Some of the children laughed at the very idea of rain on Dune, but Kynes kept talking, explaining the steps of his process to reap the faintest breath of water vapor from the air. He would collect every sparkle of dew in the shadows to help twist Arrakis in the way he required, to pave the way for a brilliant new ecology. "You must think of this world in engineering terms," Kynes said, in a professorial tone. He was happy to have such an attentive audience, though he wasn't sure how much they understood. "This planet, taken in its entirety, is merely an expression of energy, a machine driven by its sun." He lowered his voice and looked down at a young, wide-eyed girl. "What it requires is reshaping to fit our needs. We have the ability to do that on Dune. But do we have the self-discipline and the drive?" He lifted his gaze to someone else. "That is up to us,"